to entrust herself to my honour? No. Do you prefer I should seek Monsieur d'Epernay? No. Whence, then, will come the help we need? From chance? Resumed Morel. No. From you? Yes. You thoroughly understand me, sir. Pardon my eagerness, for my life depends on your answer. Will our help come from you? Yes. You are sure of it? Yes. There was so much firmness in the look which gave this answer, no one could at any rate doubt his will, if they did his power. Oh, thank you 1,000 times. But how, unless a miracle should restore your speech, your gesture, your movement, how can you, chained to that armchair, dumb and motionless, oppose this marriage? A smile lit up the old man's face, a strange smile of the eyes on a paralyzed face. Then I must wait, asked the young man. Yes, but the contract, the same smile returned. Will you assure me it shall not be signed? Yes, said Noirtier. The contract shall not be signed, cried Morel. Oh, pardon me, sir. I can scarcely realize so great a happiness. Will they not sign it? No, said the paralytic. Notwithstanding that assurance, Morel still hesitated. Whether Noirtier understood the young man's indecision, or whether he had not full confidence in his docility, he looked steadily at him. "'What do you wish, sir?' asked Morel. "'That I should renew my promise of remaining tranquil?' Noirtier's eye remained fixed and firm, as if to imply that a promise did not suffice. Then it passed from his face to his hands. "'Shall I swear to you, sir?' asked Maximilian. "'Yes,' said the paralytic, with the same solemnity. Morel understood that the old man attached great importance to an oath. He extended his hand. "'I swear to you, on my honour,' said he, "'to await your decision respecting the course I am to pursue with Monsieur d'Epernay.' "'That is right,' said the old man. "'Now,' said Morel, "'do you wish me to retire?' "'Yes. Without seeing Mademoiselle Valentine?' Yes. Morel made a sign that he was ready to obey. But, said he, first allow me to embrace you, as your granddaughter did just now. Noirtier's expression could not be understood. The young man pressed his lips on the same spot on the old man's forehead where Valentine's had been. Then he bowed a second time and retired. He found the old servant outside the door, to whom Valentine had given directions. He conducted Morel along a dark passage, which led to a little door opening on the garden. Morel soon found the spot where he had entered. With the assistance of the shrubs, he gained the top of the wall, and by his ladder was, in an instant, in the clover field, where his cabriolet was still waiting for him. He got in it, and thoroughly wearied by so many emotions, he arrived about midnight in the Rue Mellet, threw himself on his bed, and slept soundly. 75. The Vifor Family Vault. 2 days after, a considerable crowd was assembled towards 10 o'clock in the morning round the door of Monsieur de Vifor's house, and a long file of mourning coaches and private carriages extended along the Faubourg Saint-Honoré and the Rue de la Pépinière. Among them was one of a very singular form, which appeared to have come from a distance. It was a kind of covered wagon painted black, and was one of the first at the rendezvous. Inquiry was made, and it was ascertained that, by a strange coincidence, this carriage contained the corpse of the Marquis de Saint-Marin, and that those who had come, thinking to attend one funeral, would follow two. Their number was great. The Marquis de Saint-Marin, one of the most zealous and faithful dignitaries of Louis XVIII and King Charles X, had preserved a great number of friends, and these, added to the persons whom the usages of society gave Vifor a claim on, formed a considerable body. Due information was given to the authorities, and permission obtained that the two funerals should take place at the same time. A second hearse, decked with the same funeral pomp, was brought to Monsieur de Vifor's door, and the coffin removed into it from the post-wagon. The two bodies were to be interred in the cemetery of Père Lachaise, where Monsieur de Vifor had long since had a tomb prepared for the reception of his family. The remains of poor Renée were already deposited there, whom, after 10 years of separation, her father and mother were now going to rejoin. The Parisians, always curious, always affected by funereal display, looked on with religious silence, while the splendid procession accompanied to their last abode two of the number of the old aristocracy, the greatest protectors of commerce and sincere devotees to their principles. In one of the morning coaches, Beauchamp, Debray, and Chateau Renaud were talking of the very sudden death of the Marchioness. "I saw Madame de Saint-Marin only last year at Marseille, and should have supposed she might have lived to be 100 years old from her apparent sound health and great activity of mind and body. How old was she?" "Franz assured me," replied Albert, "that she was 70 years old. But she has not died of old age, but of grief. It appears, since the death of the Marquis, which affected her very deeply, she has not completely recovered her reason."
"But of what disease did she then die?" asked Debray.
"It is said to have been a congestion of the brain, or apoplexy, which is the same thing, is it not?"
"Nearly. It is difficult to believe it was apoplexy," said Beauchamp. "Madame de Saint-Marin, whom I once saw, was short, of slender form, and of a much more nervous than sanguine temperament. Grief could hardly produce apoplexy in such a constitution as that of Madame de Saint-Marin."
"At any rate," said Albert, "whatever disease or doctor may have killed her, Monsieur de Villefort, or rather Mademoiselle Valentine, or still rather our friend France, inherits a magnificent fortune, amounting, I believe, to 80,000 livres per annum. And this fortune will be doubled at the death of the old Jacobin Noirtier."
"That is a tenacious old grandfather," said Beauchamp. "Tenacum propositi virum. One thing only puzzles me, namely, how Franz d'Epernay will like a grandfather who cannot be separated from his wife. But where is Franz?"
"In the first carriage, with Monsieur de Villefort, who considers him already as one of the family."
Such was the conversation in almost all the carriages. These two sudden deaths, so quickly following each other, astonished everyone. But no one suspected the terrible secret which Monsieur d'Avrigny had communicated in his nocturnal walk to Monsieur de Villefort. They arrived in about an hour at the cemetery. The weather was mild but dull, and in harmony with the funeral ceremony. Among the groups which flocked towards the family vault, Chateau Renaud recognized Morel, who had come alone in a cabriolet and walked silently along the path bordered with yew trees.
"You here?" said Chateau Renaud, passing his arm through the young captain's. "Are you a friend of Villefort's? How is it I have never met you at his house?"
"I am no acquaintance of Monsieur de Villefort's," answered Morel, "but I was of Madame de Saint-Marin." Albert came up to them at this moment with France.
"The time and place are but ill suited for an introduction," said Albert, "but we are not superstitious. Monsieur Morel, allow me to present to you Monsieur Franz d'Epernay, a delightful travelling companion with whom I made the tour of Italy. My dear Franz, Monsieur Maximilian Morel, an excellent friend I have acquired in your absence, and whose name you will hear me mention every time I make an allusion to affection, wit, or amiability."
Morel hesitated for a moment. He feared it would be hypocritical to accost in a friendly manner the man whom he was tacitly opposing, but his oath and the gravity of the circumstances recurred to his memory. He struggled to conceal his emotion and bowed to France.
"Mademoiselle de Villefort is in deep sorrow, is she not?" said Debray to France.
"Extremely," replied he. "She looked so pale this morning, I scarcely knew her." These apparently simple words pierced Morel to the heart. This man had then seen Valentine and spoken to her. The young and high-spirited officer required all his strength of mind to resist breaking his oath.
He took the arm of Chateau Renaud and turned towards the vault where the attendants had already placed the two coffins. The V4 vault formed a square of white stones about 20 feet high. An interior partition separated the two families, and each compartment had its entrance door. Here were not, as in other tombs, those ignoble drawers one above another, where economy encloses its dead with an inscription resembling a ticket. All that was visible within the bronze gates was a gloomy-looking room, separated by a wall from the vault itself. The two doors before mentioned were in the middle of this wall and enclosed the V4 and Samarin coffins. The two coffins were placed on trestles previously prepared for their reception in the right-hand division belonging to the Samarin family. V4, France, and a few near relatives alone entered the sanctuary. As the religious ceremonies had all been performed at the door, and there was no address given, the party all separated. Chateau Renaud, Albert, and Morel went one way, and Debray and Beauchamp the other. France remained with Monsieur de Villefort. At the gate of the cemetery, Morel made an excuse to wait. He saw France and Monsieur de Villefort get into the same mourning coach, and thought this tête-à-tête foreboded evil. He then returned to Paris, and although in the same carriage with Chateau Renaud and Albert, he did not hear one word of their conversation. As France was about to take leave of Monsieur Villefort,
"When shall I see you again?" said the latter.
"I am at your command, sir. Shall we return together?"
"If not unpleasant to you."
"On the contrary, I shall feel much pleasure."
Thus the future father and son-in-law stepped into the same carriage, and Morel, seeing them pass, became uneasy. Villefort and France returned to the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. The procureur, without going to see either his wife or his daughter, passed rapidly to his cabinet, and offering the young man a chair,
"Monsieur d'Epernay," said he, "allow me to remind you at this moment, which is perhaps not so ill-chosen as at first sight may appear, for obedience to the wishes of the departed is the first offering which should be made at their tomb. Allow me, then, to remind you of the wish expressed by Madame de Saint-Marin on her deathbed that Valentine's wedding might not be deferred. You know the affairs of the deceased are in perfect order, and her will bequeaths to Valentine the entire property of the Saint-Marin family. The notary showed me the documents yesterday, which will enable us to draw up the contract immediately.
You may call on the notary, Monsieur Deschamps, Place Beauvau, Faubourg Saint-Honoré, and you have my authority to inspect those deeds."
"Sir," replied Monsieur d'Epernay, "it is not perhaps the moment for Mademoiselle Valentine, who is in deep distress, to think of a husband. Indeed, I fear
Valentine will have no greater pleasure than that of fulfilling her grandmama's last injunctions. There will be no obstacle from that quarter, I assure you."
"In that case," replied France, "as I shall raise none, you may make arrangements when you please. I have pledged my word, and shall feel pleasure and happiness in adhering to it."
"Then," said Villefort, "nothing further is required. The contract was to have been signed 3 days since. We shall find it all ready, and can sign it today."
"But the morning," said France, hesitating.
"Fear not," replied Villefort. "No ceremony will be neglected in my house. Mademoiselle de Villefort may retire during the prescribed 3 months to her estate of Saint-Marin. I say hers, for she inherits it today. There, after a few days, if you like, the civil marriage shall be celebrated without pomp or ceremony. Madame de Saint-Marin wished her granddaughter should be married there. When that is over, you, sir, can return to Paris while your wife passes the time of her mourning with her mother-in-law."
"As you please, sir," said France.
"Then," replied Monsieur de Villefort, "have the kindness to wait 30 minutes. Valentine shall come down into the drawing-room. I will send for Monsieur Deschamps. We will read and sign the contract before we separate, and this evening Madame de Villefort shall accompany Valentine to her estate, where we will rejoin them in a week."
"Sir," said France, "I have one request to make."
"What is it?"
"I wish Albert de Morcerf and Raoul de Chateau Renaud to be present at this signature. You know they are my witnesses."
"Half an hour will suffice to apprise them. Will you go for them yourself, or will you send?"
"I prefer going, sir."
"I shall expect you, then, in half an hour, Baron, and Valentine will be ready."
Franz bowed and left the room. Scarcely had the door closed when Monsieur de Villefort sent to tell Valentine to be ready in the drawing-room in half an hour, as he expected the notary and Monsieur d'Epernay and his witnesses. The news caused a great sensation throughout the house. Madame de Villefort would not believe it, and Valentine was thunderstruck. She looked round for help, and would have gone down to her grandfather's room, but meeting Monsieur de Villefort on the stairs, he took her arm and led her into the drawing-room. In the anteroom, Valentine met Barrois and looked despairingly at the old servant. One moment after, Madame de Villefort entered the drawing-room with her little Edouard. It was evident that she had shared the grief of the family, for she was pale and looked fatigued. She sat down, took Edouard on her knees, and from time to time pressed almost convulsively to her bosom this child on whom her affections appeared centred. Two carriages were soon heard to enter the courtyard. One was the notary's, the other that of Franz and his friends. In a moment the whole party was assembled. Valentine was so pale one might trace the blue veins from her temples round her eyes and down her cheeks. Franz was deeply affected. Chateau Renaud and Albert looked at each other with amazement. The ceremony, which was just concluded, had not appeared more sorrowful than did that which was commencing. Madame de Villefort had placed herself in the shade behind a velvet curtain, and, as she constantly bent over her child, it was difficult to read the expression of her face. Monsieur de Villefort was, as usual, unmoved. The notary, after having, according to the customary method, arranged the papers on the table, taken his place in an armchair, and raised his spectacles, turned towards France.
"Are you Monsieur France de Quesnel, Baron d'Epernay?" asked he, although he knew it perfectly.
"Yes, sir," replied France. The notary bowed.
"I have, then, to inform you, sir, at the request of Monsieur de Villefort, that your projected marriage with Mademoiselle de Villefort has changed the feeling of Monsieur Noirtier towards his grandchild, and that he disinherits her entirely of the fortune he would have left her. Let me hasten to add," continued he, "that the testator, having only the right to alienate a part of his fortune, and having alienated it all, the will not bear scrutiny, and is declared null and void." "Yes," said Villefort, "but I warn Monsieur d'Epernay that during my lifetime my father's will shall never be scrutinized, my position forbidding any doubt to be entertained."
"Sir," said France, "I regret much such a question has been raised in the presence of Mademoiselle Valentine. I have never inquired the amount of her fortune, which, however limited it may be, exceeds mine. My family has sought consideration in this alliance with Monsieur de Villefort. All I seek is happiness." Valentine imperceptibly thanked him, while two silent tears rolled down her cheeks.
"Besides, sir," said Villefort, addressing himself to his future son-in-law, "excepting the loss of a portion of your hopes, this unexpected will need not personally wound you. Monsieur Noirtier's weakness of mind sufficiently explains it. It is not because Mademoiselle Valentine is going to marry you that he is angry, but because she will marry. A union with any other would have caused him the same sorrow. Old age is selfish, sir, and Mademoiselle de Villefort has been a faithful companion to Monsieur Noirtier, which she cannot be when Madame la Baronne d'Epernay.
My father's melancholy state prevents our speaking to him on many subjects, which the weakness of his mind would incapacitate him from understanding, and I am perfectly convinced that at the present time, although he knows his granddaughter is going to be married, Monsieur Noirtier has even forgotten the name of his intended grandson."
Monsieur de Villefort had scarcely said this when the door opened and Barrois appeared. "Gentlemen," said he, in a tone strangely firm for a servant speaking to his masters under such solemn circumstances, "gentlemen, Monsieur Noirtier de Villefort wishes to speak immediately to Monsieur France de Canel, Baron d'Epernay." He, as well as the notary, that there might be no mistake in the person, gave all his titles to the bridegroom-elect. Villefort started. Madame de Villefort let her son slip from her knees. Valentine rose, pale and dumb as a statue. Albert and Chateau Renaud exchanged a second look, more full of amazement than the first. The notary looked at Villefort.
"It is impossible," said the procureur du roi. "Monsieur d'Epernay cannot leave the drawing-room at present." "It is at this moment," replied Barrois, with the same firmness, "that Monsieur Noirtier, my master, wishes to speak on important subjects to Monsieur France d'Epernay."
"Grandpapa Noirtier can speak now, then," said Edouard, with his usual quickness.
However, his remark did not make Madame de Villefort even smile, so much was every mind engaged and so solemn was the situation. Astonishment was at its height. A kind of smile was perceptible on Madame de Villefort's countenance. Valentine instinctively raised her eyes, as if to thank heaven.
"Pray go, Valentine," said Monsieur de Villefort, "and see what this new fancy of your grandfather's is."
Valentine rose quickly, and was hastening joyfully towards the door, when Monsieur de Villefort altered his intention.
"Stop," said he, "I will go with you."
"Excuse me, sir," said France. "Since Monsieur Noirtier sent for me, I am ready to attend to his wish. Besides, I shall be happy to pay my respects to him, not having yet had the honour of doing so."
"Pray, sir," said Villefort with marked uneasiness, "do not disturb yourself."
"Forgive me, sir," said France in a resolute tone. "I would not lose this opportunity of proving to Monsieur Noirtier how wrong it would be of him to encourage feelings of dislike to me, which I am determined to conquer, whatever they may be, by my devotedness."
And without listening to Villefort, he rose and followed Valentine, who was running downstairs with the joy of a shipwrecked mariner who finds a rock to cling to. Monsieur de Villefort followed them. Chateau Renaud and Morcerf exchanged a third look of still increasing wonder. 76. A Signed Statement. Noirtier was prepared to receive them, dressed in black and installed in his armchair. When the three persons he expected had entered, he looked at the door, which his valet immediately closed.
"Listen," whispered Villefort to Valentine, who could not conceal her joy. "If Monsieur Noirtier wishes to communicate anything which would delay your marriage, I forbid you to understand him."
Valentine blushed, but did not answer. Villefort, approaching Noirtier,
"Here is Monsieur France d'Epernay," said he. "You requested to see him. We have all wished for this interview, and I trust it will convince you how ill-formed are your objections to Valentine's marriage."
Noirtier answered only by a look which made Villefort's blood run cold. He motioned to Valentine to approach. In a moment, thanks to her habit of conversing with her grandfather, she understood he asked for a key. Then his eye was fixed on the drawer of a small chest between the windows. She opened the drawer and found a key, and, understanding that was what he wanted, again watched his eyes, which turned towards an old secretaire, long since forgotten, and supposed to contain none but useless documents.
"Shall I open the secretaire?" asked Valentine.
"Yes," said the old man.
"And the drawers?"
"Yes."
"Those at the side?"
"No."
"The middle one?"
"Yes." Valentine opened it and drew out a bundle of papers.
"Is that what you wish for?" asked she. "No." She took successively all the other papers out till the drawer was empty. "But there are no more," said she. Noirtier's eye was fixed on the dictionary. "Yes, I understand, grandfather," said the young girl. She pointed to each letter of the alphabet. At the letter S, the old man stopped her. She opened and found the word secret.
"Ah, is there a secret spring?" said Valentine.
"Yes," said Noirtier.
"And who knows it?"
Noirtier looked at the door where the servant had gone out.
"Barrois?" said she.
"Yes." Valentine went to the door and called Barrois. Fifor's impatience during this scene made the perspiration roll from his forehead, and France was stupefied. The old servant came.
"Barrois," said Valentine, "my grandfather has told me to open that drawer in the secrétaire, but there is a secret spring in it which you know. Will you open it?"
Barrois looked at the old man. "Obey," said Noirtier's intelligent eye. Barrois touched a spring. The false bottom came out, and they saw a bundle of papers tied with a black string.
"Is that what you wish for?" said Barrois.
"Yes."
"Shall I give these papers to Monsieur de Villefort?"
"No."
"To Mademoiselle Valentine?"
"No."
"To Monsieur France d'Epernay?"
"Yes." France, astonished, advanced a step.
"To me, sir?" said he.
"Yes." France took them from Barrois, and, casting his eye on the cover, read,
"To be given, after my death, to General Durand, who shall bequeath the packet to his son, with an injunction to preserve it, as containing an important document."
"Well, sir," asked France, "what do you wish me to do with this paper?"
"To preserve it, sealed up as it is, doubtless," said the Procureur du Roi.
"No, no," replied Noirtier, eagerly.
"Do you wish him to read it?" said Valentine.
"Yes," replied the old man.
"You understand, Baron. My grandfather wishes you to read this paper," said Valentine.
"Then let us sit down," said Villefort impatiently, "for it will take some time."
"Sit down," said the old man. Villefort took a chair, but Valentine remained standing by her father's side, and France before him, holding the mysterious paper in his hand.
"Read," said the old man.
France untied it, and in the midst of the most profound silence read, "Extract of the procès-verbal of a meeting of the Bonapartist Club in the Rue Saint-Jacques, held February 5th, 1815. France stopped.
"February 5th, 1815, said he. "It is the day my father was murdered."
Valentine and Villefort were dumb. The eye of the old man alone seemed to say clearly, "Go on."
"But it was on leaving this club," said he, "my father disappeared."
Noirtier's eye continued to say, "Read." He resumed.
"The undersigned, Louis-Jacques Beaurepaire, Lieutenant Colonel of Artillery, Etienne Duchampy, General of Brigade, and Claude Le Chapal, Keeper of Woods and Forests, declare that on the 4th of February, a letter arrived from the Isle of Elba, recommending to the kindness and the confidence of the Bonapartist Club, General Flavien de Canel, who, having served the Emperor from 1804 to 1814, was supposed to be devoted to the interests of the Napoleon dynasty, notwithstanding the title of Baron, which Louis XVIII had just granted to him with his estate of Epernay. A note was, in consequence, addressed to General de Canel, begging him to be present at the meeting next day, the 5th. The note indicated neither the street nor the number of the house the meeting was to be held. It bore no signature, but it announced to the general that someone would call for him if he would be ready at 9 o'clock. The meetings were always held from that time till midnight. At 9 o'clock, the president of the club presented himself. The general was ready.
The president informed him one of the conditions of his introduction was that he should be eternally ignorant of the place of meeting, and that he would allow his eyes to be bandaged, swearing that he would not endeavour to take off the bandage. The General de Canel accepted the condition, and promised on his honour not to seek to discover the road they took. The General's carriage was ready, but the President told him it was impossible he could use it, for it was useless to blindfold the master if the coachman knew through what streets he went. "What must then be done?" asked the General. "I have my carriage here," said the President. "Have you, then, so much confidence in your servant that you can entrust him with a secret you will not allow me to know?" "Our coachman is a member of the club," said the president. "We shall be driven by a state councillor." "Then we run another risk," said the general, laughing, "that of being upset." We insert this joke to prove that the general was not in the least compelled to attend this meeting, but that he came willingly. When they were seated in the carriage, the president reminded the general of his promise to allow his eyes to be bandaged, to which he made no opposition. On the road, the president thought he saw the general make an attempt to remove the handkerchief and reminded him of his oath. "True," said the general. The carriage stopped at a passage leading to the Rue Saint-Jacques. The general alighted, leaning on the arm of the president, of whose dignity he was not aware, considering him simply as a member of the club. They crossed the passage, mounted to the first story, and entered the meeting room. The deliberations had already commenced. The members, apprised of the sort of presentation which was to be made that evening, were all in attendance. When in the middle of the room, the general was invited to remove his bandage. He did so immediately, and was surprised to see so many well-known faces in a society of whose existence he had till then been ignorant. They questioned him as to his sentiments, but he contented himself with answering that the letters from the Isle of Elba ought to have informed them. France interrupted himself by saying, "My father was a royalist. They need not have asked his sentiments, which were well known."
"And hence," said Villefort, "arose my affection for your father, my dear Monsieur France. A similarity of opinion soon binds."
"Read," again said the old man. France continued. The president then sought to make him speak more explicitly, but Monsieur de Canel replied that he wished first to know what they wanted with him. He was then informed of the contents of the letter from the Isle of Elba, in which he was recommended to the club as a man who would be likely to advance the interests of their party. One paragraph alluded to the return of Bonaparte, and promised another letter and further details on the arrival of the Pharaon, belonging to the shipbuilder Morel of Marseille, whose captain was entirely devoted to the Emperor. During all this time, the general, on whom they thought to have relied as on a brother, manifested evidently signs of discontent and repugnance. When the reading was finished, he remained silent, with knit brow. "Well," asked the president, "what do you say to this letter, general?" "I say that it is too soon after declaring myself for Louis the 18th to break my vow in behalf of the ex-emperor." This answer was too clear to be mistaken as to his sentiments. "General," said the president, "we acknowledge no King Louis the 18th, nor an ex-emperor, but His Majesty the Emperor and King, driven from France, which is his kingdom, by violence and treason." "Excuse me, gentlemen," said the general, "you may not acknowledge Louis the 18th, but I do, as he has made me a baron and a field marshal, and I shall never forget that for these two titles I am indebted to his happy return to France."
"Sir," said the president, rising with gravity, "be careful what you say.
Your words clearly show us that they are deceived concerning you in the Isle of Elba, and have deceived us. The communication has been made to you in consequence of the confidence placed in you, and which does you honour. Now we discover our error. A title and promotion attach you to the government we wish to overturn. We will not constrain you to help us. We enroll no one against his conscience, but we will compel you to act generously, even if you are not disposed to do so. You would call acting generously knowing your conspiracy and not informing against you. That is what I should call becoming your accomplice. You see, I am more candid than you. Ah, my father, said Franz, interrupting himself, I understand now why they murdered him. Valentine could not help casting one glance towards the young man, whose filial enthusiasm it was delightful to behold. Vifor walked to and fro behind them. Noirtier watched the expression of each one, and preserved his dignified and commanding attitude. Franz returned to the manuscript, and continued. Sir, said the President, you have been invited to join this assembly. You were not forced here. It was proposed to you to come blindfolded. You accepted. When you complied with this twofold request, you well knew we did not wish to secure the throne to Louis XVIII, or we should not take so much care to avoid the vigilance of the police. It would be conceding too much to allow you to put on a mask, to aid you in the discovery of our secret, and then to remove it, that you may ruin those who have confided in you. No. No, you must first say, if you declare yourself for the king of a day who now reigns, or for his majesty, the emperor.
I am a royalist, replied the general. I have taken the oath of allegiance to Louis XVIII, and I will adhere to it.
These words were followed by a general murmur, and it was evident several of the members were discussing the propriety of making the general repent of his rashness. The President again rose, and having imposed silence, said, Sir, you are too serious and too sensible a man not to understand the consequences of our present situation, and your candor has already dictated to us the conditions which remain for us to offer you. The General, putting his hand on his sword, exclaimed, If you talk of honor, do not begin by disavowing its laws, and impose nothing by violence. And you, sir, continued the President, with a calmness still more terrible than the General's anger, do not touch your sword, I advise you. The General looked around him with slight uneasiness. However, he did not yield, but recalling all his strength, I will not swear, said he. Then you must die, replied the President calmly. Monsieur d'Epinay became very pale. He looked round him a second time. Several members of the club were whispering and getting their arms from under their cloaks. General, said the President, do not alarm yourself. You are among men of honour, who will use every means to convince you before resorting to the last extremity. But, as you have said, you are among conspirators, you are in possession of our secret, and you must restore it to us. A significant silence followed these words, and as the general did not reply, Close the doors, said the President to the doorkeepers. The same deadly silence succeeded these words. Then the general advanced, and making a violent effort to control his feelings, I have a son, said he, and I ought to think of him, finding myself among assassins. General, said the chief of the assembly, one man may insult 50, it is the privilege of weakness, but he does wrong to use his privilege. Follow my advice, swear, and do not insult. The general, again daunted by the superiority of the chief, hesitated a moment, then, advancing to the President's desk, What is the form? Said he. It is this. I swear by my honour not to reveal to anyone what I have seen and heard on the 5th of February 1815, between 9 and 10 o'clock in the evening, and I plead guilty of death should I ever violate this oath." The general appeared to be affected by a nervous shudder, which prevented his answering for some moments. Then, overcoming his manifest repugnance, he pronounced the required oath, but in so low a tone as to be scarcely audible to the majority of the members, who insisted on his repeating it clearly and distinctly, which he did. "Now am I at liberty to retire," said the general. The president rose, appointed 3 members to accompany him, and got into the carriage with the general after bandaging his eyes. One of those 3 members was the coachman who had driven them there. The other members silently dispersed. "Where do you wish to be taken?" asked the president. "Anywhere out of your presence," replied Monsieur d'Epernay. "Beware, sir," replied the president. "You are no longer in the assembly and have only to do with individuals. Do not insult them unless you wish to be held responsible." But instead of listening, Monsieur d'Epernay went on. "You are still as brave in your carriage as in your assembly, because you are still 4 against 1. The president stopped the coach. They were at that part of the Quai des Ormes where the steps lead down to the river. "Why do you stop here?" asked d'Epernay. "Because, sir," said the president, "you have insulted a man, and that man will not go 1 step farther without demanding honorable reparation." "Another method of assassination," said the general, shrugging his shoulders. "Make no noise, sir, unless you wish me to consider you as one of those men whom you designated just now as cowards, who take their weakness for a shield. You are alone. One alone shall answer you. You have a sword by your side. I have one in my cane. You have no witness. One of these gentlemen will serve you. Now, if you please, remove your bandage." The general tore the handkerchief from his eyes. "At last," said he, "I shall know with whom I have to do." They opened the door, and the 4 men alighted. Franz again interrupted himself and wiped the cold drops from his brow. There was something awful in hearing the son, trembling and pale, read aloud these details of his father's death, which had hitherto remained unknown. Valentine clasped her hands as if in prayer. Noirtier looked at Villefort with an almost sublime expression of contempt and pride. Franz continued. "It was, as we said, the 5th of February. For 3 days there had been 5 or 6 degrees of frost. The steps were covered with ice. The general was stout and tall. The president offered him the side of the railing to assist him in getting down. The 2 witnesses followed. It was a dark night. The ground from the steps to the river was covered with snow and hoar frost. The water of the river looked black and deep. One of the seconds went for a lantern in a coal barge near, and by its light they examined the arms. The president's sword, which was simply, as he had said, one he carried in his cane, was 5 inches shorter than the general's, and had no guard. The general proposed to cast lots for the swords, but the president said it was he who had given the provocation, and when he had given it, he had supposed each would use his own arms. The witnesses endeavored to insist, but the president bade them be silent. The lantern was placed on the ground. The 2 adversaries arranged themselves, and the duel commenced. The light made the 2 swords appear like flashes of lightning. As for the men, they were scarce perceptible, the darkness was so great. Monsieur le Général d'Epernay passed for one of the best swordsmen in the army, but he was pressed so closely in the onset that he missed his aim and fell. The witnesses thought he was dead, but his adversary, who knew he had not struck him, offered him the assistance of his hand to rise. This circumstance irritated instead of calming the general, and he rushed on his adversary. but his opponent did not miss one stroke. Receiving him on his sword, 3 times the general drew back, and finding himself foiled, returned to the charge. At the 3rd, he fell again. They thought he slipped, as at first, and the witnesses, seeing he did not move, approached and endeavoured to raise him, but the one who passed his arm round the body found it was moistened with blood. The general, who had almost fainted, revived. "Ah," said he, "they have sent some fencing master to fight with me." The president, without answering, approached the witness who held the lantern, and raising his sleeve, showed him 2 wounds he had received in his arm. Then, opening his coat and unbuttoning his waistcoat, displayed his side, pierced with 3rd wound. Still, he had not even uttered a sigh. The General d'Epernay died 5 minutes after. Franz read these last words in a voice so choked that they were hardly audible, and then stopped, passing his hand over his eyes as if to dispel a cloud. But after a moment's silence he continued. The president went up the steps, after pushing his sword into his cane. A track of blood on the snow marked his course. He had scarcely arrived at the top when he heard a heavy splash in the water. It was the general's body, which the witnesses had just thrown into the river after ascertaining he was dead. The general fell, then, in a loyal duel and not in ambush, as it might have been reported. In proof of this, we have signed this paper to establish the truth of the facts, lest the moment should arrive when either of the actors in this terrible scene should be accused of premeditated murder or of infringement of the laws of honour. Signed, Beaurepaire, Duchampy, and Le Chapelle.
When Franz had finished reading this account, so dreadful for a son, when Valentine, pale with emotion, had wiped away a tear, when Vifor, trembling and crouched in a corner, had endeavoured to lessen the storm by supplicating glances at the implacable old man.
"Sir," said d'Epernay to Noirtier, "since you are well acquainted with all these details, which are attested by honourable signatures, since you appear to take some interest in me, although you have only manifested it hitherto by causing me sorrow, refuse me not one final satisfaction. Tell me the name of the president of the club, that I may at least know who killed my father." Vifor mechanically felt for the handle of the door. Valentine, who understood sooner than anyone her grandfather's answer, and who had often seen 2 scars upon his right arm, drew back a few steps.
"Mademoiselle," said Franz, turning towards Valentine, "unite your efforts with mine to find out the name of the man who made me an orphan at 2 years of age."
Valentine remained dumb and motionless.
"Hold, sir," said Vifor, "do not prolong this dreadful scene. The names have been purposely concealed. My father himself does not know who this president was, and if he knows, he cannot tell you. Proper names are not in the dictionary."
"Oh, misery," cried Franz. "The only hope which sustained me and enabled me to read to the end was that of knowing at last the name of him who killed my father."
"Sir, sir," cried he, turning to Noirtier, "do what you can. Make me understand in some way."
"Yes," replied Noirtier.
"Oh, mademoiselle, mademoiselle," cried Franz, "your grandfather says he can indicate the person. Help me, lend me your assistance."
Noirtier looked at the dictionary. Franz took it with a nervous trembling and repeated the letters of the alphabet successively until he came to M. At that letter, the old man signified, "Yes."
"M?" repeated Franz.
The young man's finger glided over the words, but at each one Noirtier answered by a negative sign. Valentine hid her head between her hands.
At length, Franz arrived at the word, myself. Yes.
You, cried Franz, whose hair stood on end. You, Monsieur Noirtier, you killed my father?
Yes, replied Noirtier, fixing a majestic look on the young man. Franz fell powerless on a chair. Vifor opened the door and escaped, for the idea had entered his mind to stifle the little remaining life in the old man's heart.
77. Progress of Monsieur Cavalcanti the Younger. Meanwhile, Monsieur Cavalcanti the Elder had returned to his service, not in the army of His Majesty the Emperor of Austria, but at the gaming table of the Baths of Lucca, of which he was one of the most assiduous courtiers. He had spent every farthing that had been allowed for his journey as a reward for the majestic and solemn manner in which he had maintained his assumed character of father. Monsieur Andrea, at his departure, inherited all the papers which proved that he had indeed the honour of being the son of the Marquis Bartolomeo and the Marchioness Oliva Corsinari. He was now fairly launched in that Parisian society which gives such ready access to foreigners and treats them not as what they really are, but as what they wish to be considered. Besides, what is required of a young man in Paris? To speak its language tolerably, to make a good appearance, to be a good gamester, and to pay in cash. They are certainly less particular with a foreigner than with a Frenchman. Andrea had then, in a fortnight, attained a very fair position. He was entitled Monsieur le Comte. He was said to possess 50,000 livres per annum, and his father's immense riches, buried in the quarries of Saravezza, were a constant theme. Such was the state of society in Paris at the period we bring before our readers, when Monte Cristo went one evening to pay Monsieur Danglars a visit. Monsieur Danglars was out, but the Count was asked to go and see the Baroness, and he accepted the invitation. When Monte Cristo entered the boudoir, to which we have already once introduced our readers, and where the Baroness was examining some drawings, which her daughter passed to her after having looked at them with Monsieur Cavalcanti, his presence soon produced its usual effect, and it was with smiles that the Baroness received the Count, although she had been a little disconcerted at the announcement of his name. The latter took in the whole scene at a glance. The Baroness was partially reclining on a causeuse. Eugénie sat near her, and Cavalcanti was standing. Cavalcanti, dressed in black like one of Goethe's heroes, with japanned shoes and open white silk stockings, passed a white and tolerably nice-looking hand through his light hair, in the midst of which sparkled a diamond which, in spite of Monte Cristo's advice, the vain young man had been unable to resist putting on his little finger. This movement was accompanied by killing glances at Mademoiselle Danglars and sighs addressed to the same party. Mademoiselle Danglars was still the same, cold, beautiful, and satirical. Not one of these glances nor one sigh was lost on her. They might have been said to fall on the shield of Minerva, which some philosophers assert protected sometimes the breast of Sappho. Eugénie bowed coldly to the Count, and availed herself of the first moment when the conversation became earnest to escape to her study, whence, very soon, two cheerful and noisy voices being heard, in connection with some notes off the piano, assured Monte Cristo that Mademoiselle Danglars preferred to his society, and to that of Monsieur Cavalcanti, the company of Mademoiselle Louise d'Army, her singing governess. It was then, especially while conversing with Madame Danglars, and apparently absorbed by the charm of the conversation, the Count remarked Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti's solicitude, his manner of listening to the music at the door he dared not pass, and of manifesting his admiration. The banker soon returned. His first look was certainly directed towards Monte Cristo, but the second was for Andrea. As for his wife, he bowed to her, as some husbands do to their wives, but in a way which bachelors will never comprehend until a very extensive code is published on conjugal life.
"Have not the ladies invited you to join them at the piano?" said Danglars to Andrea.
"Alas, no, sir," replied Andrea with a sigh, still more remarkable than the former ones. Danglars immediately advanced towards the door and opened it. The two young ladies were seen seated on the same chair at the piano, accompanying themselves, each with one hand, a fancy to which they had accustomed themselves, and performed admirably. Mademoiselle d'Army, whom they then perceived through the open doorway, formed with Eugénie one of those living pictures of which the Germans are so fond. She was somewhat beautiful and exquisitely genteel, a little fairy-like figure with large curls falling on her neck, which was rather too long, as Perugino sometimes makes his virgins, and her eyes dull from fatigue. She was said to have a weak chest, and like Antonia of the Violon de Cremon, she would die one day while singing. Monte Cristo cast one rapid and curious glance round this sanctum. It was the first time he had ever seen Mademoiselle d'Army, of whom he had heard much.
"Well," said the banker to his daughter, "are we then all to be excluded?"
He then led the young man into the study, and, either by chance or manoeuvre, the door was partially closed after Andrea, so that from the place where they sat neither the Count nor the Baroness could see anything. But as the banker had accompanied Andrea, Madame Danglars appeared to take no notice of it. The Count soon heard Andrea's voice singing a Corsican song, accompanied by the piano. While the Count smiled at hearing this song, which made him lose sight of Andrea in the recollection of Benedetto, Madame Danglars was boasting to Monte Cristo of her husband's strength of mind, who, that very morning, had lost 300,000 or 400,000 francs by a failure at Milan. The praise was well deserved, for had not the Count heard it from the Baroness, or by one of those means by which he knew everything, the Baron's countenance would not have led him to suspect it.
"Hum," thought Monte Cristo, "he begins to conceal his losses. A month since he boasted of them." Then aloud, "Oh, madame, Monsieur Danglars is so skilful, he will soon regain at the Bourse what he loses elsewhere." "I see you are maintaining an erroneous idea, as well as many more," said Madame Danglars. "What is it?" said Monte Cristo.
"That Monsieur Danglars gambles, whereas he never plays."
"Truly, madame, I recollect Monsieur Debray told me. Apropos, what has become of him? I have seen nothing of him the last 3 or 4 days."
"Nor I," said Madame Danglars. "But you began a sentence, sir, and did not finish."
"Which?"
"Monsieur Debray had told you."
"Truly, he told me it was you who sacrificed to the demon of the card table."
"I was once very fond of it, but I do not play now."
"Then you are wrong, madame. Fortune is precarious, and if I were a woman and fate had made me a banker's wife, whatever might be my confidence in my husband's good fortune, still, in speculation, you know, there is great risk. Well, I would secure for myself a fortune independent of him, even if I acquired it by placing my interest in hands unknown to him." Madame Danglars blushed, in spite of all her efforts.
"Stay," said Monte Cristo, as though he had not observed her confusion. "I have heard of a lucky hit that was made yesterday on the Neapolitan bonds." "I have none, nor have I ever possessed any. But really, we have talked long enough of money, Count. We are like two stockbrokers. Have you heard how fate is persecuting the poor Vifors?"
"What has happened?"
said the Count, apparently ignorant of all. "You know the Marquis de Saint-Marin died a few days after he had set out on his journey to Paris, and the Marchioness a few days after her arrival."
"Yes," said Monte Cristo, "I have heard that."
"But that is not all."
"Not all? No.
They were going to marry their daughter to Monsieur France d'Epernay."
"Is it broken off?"
"Yesterday morning, it appears, France declined the honor."
"Indeed.
And is the reason known?"